The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Wumen Khan Koan collection, the bell sound in the priest's robe, the main case. Master Yunmen said, "Look, this world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your priest's robe at the sound of the bell?" Wumen's commentary. Now, in studying Zen and disciplining oneself in Zen, one must strictly avoid following sounds and clinging to forms. Even though one may be enlightened by hearing a sound or have one's mind clarified by seeing a form, this is just a matter of course. It's nothing to talk about either. If a Zen person is able to master sounds and control forms, and thus can he clearly see the reality of everything and is wonderfully free in everything they do. Though it may be so, you tell me, does the sound come to your ear, or does your ear go to the sound? Even if you're able to transcend both sound and silence, how do you speak of this? If you listen with your ear, you cannot truly get it. When you hear with your eye, then you know. Woman's poem. If you understand it, all things are one. If you do not, they're different and separate. If you do not understand it, all things are one. If you do, they're different and separate. This is a well-known koan. And I thought it would be good, given the retreat that's been going on for much of this week with the Dharmakates folks, you younger than older folks. I don't know how to describe you. It's been really nice having you here. Appreciate your coming and throwing yourself into this. What is Zen training? When the Buddha himself spoke about training, spiritual training, what is that? We understand it if you're an athlete, if you're a musician, in other performing arts, you train. We can train in academics. What does it mean to train? I often find it interesting to look at just the simple definitions of words. To train means to teach a particular skill or type of behavior through practice and instruction over a period of time. To develop and improve a mental or physical faculty. To train a plant means to try and get it to grow in a particular direction or to take a particular shape. To train can mean to point or aim something in some desired direction. The skills and behavior of this training, life as a bodhisattva, an awakened being through wisdom, a selfless compassion through words and actions, over a period of time, as much as you like to give it, the whole of your life, lifetimes, mental and physical faculties, mindfulness, concentration, equanimity, patience, wisdom, generosity, loving kindness, to cause to grow in a particular direction towards intimacy, to be free of all false separations, point or aim something in a particular direction, how can I be of service? One of the wonderful things about a path, because we tend to think so much in terms of solidified notions of process and goal, right? In which you're going to fail or you're going to succeed. Those are your options. And if you succeed, then there's the next go around, and the next, and the next. And if you fail, well, sorry about that. A path is an ongoing thing. It's an everyday thing. It's an every moment thing. The notion of failure doesn't really make sense. Even if you walk away from it, You're just choosing where you're going to direct your attention. You may be making choices that are going to train you in different ways, even though you may not think of it that way. In a certain sense, we've been practicing all of our lives, just not very consciously. Distraction, a distracted mind, a habitual stream of thought or emotion is a result of having practiced, not within mindfulness, but just having repeated something over and over again. Here, Yunmen asks this question. The world is vast and wide. So those of you who've been here at the end of morning zazen, we chant the verse of the Kesa, vast is the robe of liberation. The Kesa is the monastic robe, but it also is the raksu, the smaller robe that monks and lay students wear as a sign of having received the Buddhist Sapa precepts. Dogen said that when he went to China, he was unfamiliar with the practice of placing it on the top of our head when we chant that verse, and he said he wept. He was so moved by that form, that gesture, that intimacy. And so, Yunmen, maybe that just happened. The end of morning zazen, everyone's chanted, the monastics are putting on their robes, and before they stand up to do service, he said, look, all of you, this world is vast and wide. Why did you just put on your robe at the sound of the bell? The Buddha said, you are never not free. That's the basic good news. You are never not free. In fact, no matter what you do, you cannot change that. That's what we call Buddha nature. And yet, the power of our mind, our views, and our attachments are so strong that they create what appears to be a sort of almost inarguable reality, almost, otherwise we wouldn't be here, that manifests in our actual experience of things. That is that I am not free. I am bound. That's how powerful our mind is. To create that sense that it's not just an idea I'm not free, but I'm experiencing my lack of freedom. I'm seeing other people's lack of freedom. It seems to be the human condition. But what the Buddha realized, in a sense, it is the conditioned human, the socialized, the habit-forming result of a human life. Master Dogen said, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The true vehicle is self-sufficient. What need is there for special effort? The whole body is free from dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It's never apart from this very place. What is the use of traveling around to practice? And yet, if there is a hair's breadth deviation, it's like the gap between heaven and earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind becomes lost in confusion. So when we seem bound up in knots, the Buddha spoke of it this way, then first we have to notice, I'm bound. That may seem obvious. It's not. There can be obvious ways in which we're bound. But we might not see it as being bound. We might just see it as something you're doing to me. Or as a result of some external conditions. I don't see it that I am bound. So first I have to see that. Because if I don't see that, I can't start looking in the right direction. I can't take responsibility for my lack of freedom. And then I have to learn how to examine that, to turn towards that. What does that even mean? I have to develop some skills in beginning to untie that knot, which means first I have to learn how to live with it. Now, I've been living with it a long time, but I have to learn how to live with it differently, peacefully, seeing it not as an enemy, but ultimately as an ally. That knot is going to help me if I put it into service to be free of the knot. So we train the body and mind to return to its natural, uncontrived state. But how do we do that? How do we train? This was a question that must have occupied the Buddha's attention a lot. I can only think, right? He could have said, well, you all have to do exactly what I did. So you have to go to these two teachers and realize, no, that's not it. And then you have to live an ascetic life for 6 years and realize that's not it. And then come back and talk to me. He didn't do that. He gave them the fruit, gave us the fruit of the different paths he had taken that he found fruitless, and began to create, based in his own experience, what he called a path of training. I remember years ago when I was traveling to some different centers and spending time in each place, and I was at a Tibetan Buddhist center, a well-known teacher, and we were doing a traditional Tibetan Buddhist ceremony, which was quite elaborate. And in the middle of it, there was a mando, and she turned to me and she said, how is Zen different from Vajrayana teachings? And I thought for a second, I said, you guys have way more stuff. But we have stuff too. We definitely have stuff. So what do we do about that? Why do we have stuff in a path that is based in non-attachment, non-accumulation? As Master Wu Men says, we must strictly avoid following sounds and clinging to forms. But we've got some sounds and forms. Another translation of Wu Men's comment is, this world stretches boundless away, so why let a bell sound tell you when to put on your seven-piece robe? Strictly avoid following sounds and clinging to forms. This is something that was very important to Dada Roshi. It's, I think, one of the reasons the impetus behind developing the Eight Gates, so that we were not only doing these traditional forms of practice, but we were examining them. What is Zazen? What is liturgy? Why do we do liturgy? And not in a get lost in intellectual concepts and, you know, treatises in the mind, but understand at a more direct level why. I think his desire was that we come to the same place that Yunmen is trying to get his students to come to. Why do we do this? At the end of the Wumenkan, Wumen has some, who compiled this collection of koans, he's got some warnings. And every tradition, I don't know about every Buddhist tradition, but I know the major Buddhist traditions all carry, along with their teachings, warnings. These are the ways in which students not only can, but almost certainly will, in certain moments, to certain degrees, get caught, get lost, misunderstand, go off track. The Buddha said it's like a snake. If you don't know how to pick it up, you might get bit. It's like we have to learn how to actually engage in the Dharma well, so it serves us well. That's why we're careful about how the teachings are presented. We train together. In our tradition, that's why there's so much contact between teachers and students. So like when a person gives beginning instruction to a group of 10 or 15, 20 people, the senior or the teacher knows what they've said, but they don't know what's been heard. They don't know what each person has heard and what they've actually taken in, absorbed, what they haven't heard, and then how do they apply what they've heard? Are they applying it correctly in a way that's actually going to help them? So that's one of the reasons face-to-face teaching is important. And in the Zen warning, Wu Men says, to observe the regulations and keep to the rules is tying oneself without a rope. To just follow the course. Do what everybody else is doing. Follow the rules. Right? Because that's what we do. Don't think. Don't examine. Just follow. He says, that's tying yourself up without a rope. To act freely and unrestrainedly, just as one wishes, is to do what heretics and demons would do. In the very early years, a lot of people came in here thinking, that's what Zen is. That's what freedom is. I just do whatever I want. I remember we were doing a retreat, and people were just coming into Zazen in the dawn, morning. And there's somebody who had been sitting a little bit earlier who was here for the retreat, and they were leaving. And I was a monitor, and I said, we're just getting ready to sit. And he said, oh, no, I've already done my meditation. I'm going to go out for a walk. And I said, well, it's nice that you came in early, but no, we actually do this together. And he was like, why? I've already done my meditation. Right? Now, that's logical. In his mind, that was very rational and logical. You sit some every morning, I've done mine, I got mine in early, now I'm out. But no, there's actually something else that's happening here. Avoid following sounds. It's beautiful. It's ugly. I love it. I can't stand this. Avoid clinging to forms. This is going to make me so happy. It's going to make me important. It's going to make me love you. It's going to make you love me. This object, this relationship, this career, this money, this meditation, this insight, this robe. We have to have sounds and forms, I think. I mean, how do you get rid of them? I mean, even if you just everybody shows up naked, that's your form, right? So the idea of being free by just not having any is not freedom. Then you're bound to not having any. You cannot pick it up. You cannot look at it. You can't engage it because we haven't learned how to do that without getting caught. And so we bring them forward, right? And maybe we do get caught. We get attached, right? To the sound of the bell, to the smell of incense, to a robe, to being a practitioner, to having done a retreat. Or we can get attached to not doing any of those things. I don't do those things. There's one teacher, I don't know if they still do, but their sort of their big banner in their advertising was no bells and whistles. Right? Simple, plain, direct. I bet they had a few bells and whistles. Right? It's hard to have not have anything, right? But that can be another attachment. No, I don't. I'm free of all that. I don't need that. So Zazen, you see, you hear, you think, you feel, but can we do that without grabbing, entangling, clinging, being deceived? That's the practice. So we can adopt a kind of a blind approach, which is to some degree how we come into practice, little if any mindfulness, not really seeing the relationship between cause and effect. Why does this keep happening? Why does this keep happening? We can be continually surprised by disappointment. What? Or we can have a more fearful approach. I'm just not going to take any chances. And every once in a while, somebody will say, I don't want to make any commitments because I might get entangled in attachment. I say, isn't that an attachment? Already? Don't be afraid. So that can be another, to keep at a safe distance. I don't know if there's actually any distance that is safe. I mean, if a bear's running after you, you want some distance, right? But in terms of what we're really talking about here, distance doesn't make us safe. It makes us objects, things, confused, dull. The greater the distance, really, the greater the attachment. The more room there is for our confusion, for our projections, and then what is to challenge them if we don't come up close? The world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your robe? Why, when the phone rings, do you answer? Why, when someone calls your name, do you turn? Why, when you bump your head, do you scratch it or rub it? Why, when you stumble, do you right yourself? Why, when the baby cries, do you go pick her up? Why, when your stomach growls, do you have something to eat? This is not, Yunmen is not looking for a rational explanation, a reasonable response, something that you already know and everybody else knows. We can go through life just responding to things. I remember when I was young, in high school, beginning to think about, I was sort of moving towards adulthood. I already thought I was there, but you know. There were still just a couple things to figure out. And I remember looking, my parents, parents of my friends, grown-ups, people who were supposed to have figured it all out, right? Be living that life, providing the example. And I just thought, I don't know. I don't know. I saw, you know, I was waking up every day, you know, waking up, going to the bathroom, having some food, going to school, doing my work. And then after school, I thought, okay, now I'm going to wake up and instead of going to school, I'm going to go to work. And then, I don't know, maybe I'll have a family. Maybe I'll buy a house. Those things seem fine, but it's like, is that it? Is that it? Somehow that just didn't seem right. Didn't seem enough. Yunmen wants us to look more closely, to go beyond the idea of just fulfilling a task, following a rule, going along with everybody else. And you could say, well, wait a minute, we go along with everybody else all the time, right? I mean, we talk about it. Sangha is a virtue of harmony, practicing together. How do we do that? Release ourselves, the grasp of the hold, onto ourself, right? So that I'm not just following along, right, to follow the rule, but I'm also not just standing up and saying, I'm not following no damn rule. I'm free from that. What's the middle way? The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. Why do we wait? And rise and dress and eat and walk and work and love and lose the things we love, see things change? Why do we die? And this is not the philosopher's why. We're not asking for a treatise response, but an enlightened knowing, a deeper understanding, an experiential resolution of that question. That's what Yunmen is trying to bring his students to. We're immersed in ideas and opinions about everything, images, sounds, forms. There are people with great wealth, there are people with very little wealth, people in very wonderful conditions, people in very terrible conditions, who do not know the answer to this why, who may not have ever asked the question. It's hard for me to sort of imagine that a person could go through their whole life and not at some point think, that's it. But even if every single person has such a moment, in Buddhism, the question is, now what? Okay, but now what? What do I do with that? How do I respond to that? Yunmen is trying not to let his students get away from that. And they might say, no, but that's uncomfortable because I don't know, I don't understand. He says, okay, be uncomfortable. Tolerate that. Hold that question. In a way, that's the part of the weight, you might say. You might see it as a burden, you might see it as a gift of the practitioner, is to consciously, even eagerly, step into, I don't know, I don't understand, and there's a tension there, and it is uncomfortable. For years and years of my training, I would sit in this hall and listen to my teacher speak and not understand what he was saying and want to understand what he was saying, and it made me, right? It was uncomfortable. It was a tension. And I had to bear that. I didn't always bear it well. We want to just know. We want to have resolved it. We cannot resolve it without a path, some way to be on a true path, to stop, to see, to listen, to examine, to reflect, to practice. And because it's a little lonely to be in a world where everybody else seems to have more or less got their shit together and you don't, right? That's always often how it seems. Right, you sit here in this endo and you kind of look around, you think, God, everybody looks great, and I'm like coming apart. You don't know that other people are looking at you thinking the same thing. Right, and we don't get a lot of credit. I remember my grandfather sitting me down once when I was younger and I was trying to find my way. He says, son, I don't know. Like, what are you doing? Like, how's this going to work out? Are you sure you're... And I couldn't say, oh, it's all going to work out. I know where I'm headed. I know what I'm about. I couldn't say that. I just like, trust me? But I believe that if a person has a clear and an ever-clarifying intention, stays close to that, and is on a path that has honor. And I mean, is honorable in the sense that it is worthy of your precious life and attention, you will find your way. It's likely not to turn out as you thought. This was not my plan. I think the much more certain conclusion is if we don't go on a path with heart, what we can be certain of is some, if not a considerable amount of regret. When I was considering coming into training and believing I already wanted to be a monk, and this was very early and things were very, very wobbly here. Very small sangha, very little money, very little resources. And I thought, and I really didn't know. I thought, is this place going to even work? Am I going to throw all my eggs into this basket and it's just going to come apart? My teacher was a heavy smoker. My dad was a smoker. I thought, is this guy just going to die on me? I mean, really, these were thoughts. I thought, what if I'm just like a no-good monk? I dedicate my life to this, and I never actually find any peace. I never resolve anything. I mean, I really seriously considered all those things. So I thought, if I do this, I want to have my eyes open. And I remember thinking, I have done things, and they haven't worked out before. I think I can deal with it. I'll deal with it. But I don't want to consciously make a choice because I'm afraid. Because I'm going to have to live with that. I don't want to live with that. Yunmen is saying there actually is no real gap here between hearing and responding. You don't have to have a desire. There's no rule. There's no regulation at play in that part of your personhood, your being, that Yunmen is inviting you into. There's no past, present, or future. There's no approval or rejection. There's no status gained or lost. There's no meaning, and you can't explain it. That's where Yunmen is inviting you into. And that does take trust, right? Because we grow up in a world in which everything has to have an explanation. That's what my grandfather wanted, right? Just give me an explanation so I don't worry. It's hard to live in free space. When Trungpa said that, you know, the bad news is somebody just threw you out of an airplane without a parachute. That's what it feels like sometimes. The good news, he said, is there's no ground. That's the place Yunmen is inviting you to. What is intimacy? A student once asked Master Yunmen, what does correct sitting and true contemplation really mean? And Yunmen said, a coin lost in the river must be found in that same river. That's what you're doing sitting on this cushion. Having lost, seem to have lost a coin. You're looking in that very place where the coin will be found. To be intimate. Master Dogen said, the world honored one, the Buddha has intimate language, intimate practice, intimate realization. And then Dogen went on to say, and in intimacy, when we talk about that in Buddhism, we mean no separation. Subject and object in our mind, because that's the only place subject and object exists as solid entities, has been relinquished, seen through. Dogen says, when you encounter a person, you invariably hear intimate language and speak intimate language, even if we don't know. When you know yourself, then you know intimate language. Intimate means close and inseparable. So think of what you're doing in Zazen, turning your attention to the breath, something that seems close, but is, it's your breath, for goodness sake. But sometimes you might not be able to find it even. It's wily, it seems to fight you. Intimate means close and inseparable. So in Zazen, what you're doing is you're coming closer, closing that gap, the gap that the mind creates, the false gap, the false sense. He says there is no gap. And this intimacy embraces enlightened beings, it embraces you. It embraces the self, it embraces every action, it embraces all generations, it embraces every positive action, it embraces intimacy itself. It is always present, it is always sufficient. This world is vast and wide. That's what Yunmen is saying. And that vastness, that completeness, that sufficiency, it's really important to understand. It's not based on external conditions. My world will be vast and wide, complete and sufficient when I have a certain amount of money, a house on the hill, a perfect relationship, and a meaningful job. And then you leave a few spaces for, you know, individual add-ons. Your personal favorites. That's when my life will be complete and sufficient. And the Buddha said, you're setting yourself up. You will be surprised by that disappointment. Not because any of those things are not good. Those are the things of our life. These monks are putting on their robe. That's the stuff of their life. That's not what that's being said. But when we impute into that my salvation, those things are going to give me what I need, what I want, what I deserve, what I seek at the deepest level. The Buddha said they will not. They will give you some meaning, purpose, fulfillment, satisfaction, pleasure. Yes, some. But not at the deepest level. They can't. That's not what they're for. They're not made of the stuff to be able to do that. We tend to value what we can know, what we can explain, measure, and compare. Right? What does our culture teach us? Get the most, get the biggest, be the best. If that is a surefire recipe for happiness and compassion, then why aren't the people with the most stuff the happiest and the kindest? Why aren't they the most loving people on earth? The mega billionaires should be like, you can't even get close to them because there's so much love coming out of them. Right? If that story is a true story, they would be just showering down love on all of us. I don't think that's what we see. And Buddhism is kind of a proof in the pudding sort of thing. Show me. Right? Let me see. Let me verify. That's really, hear the Dharma, put it into practice, now see what happens. You verify for yourself. An old teacher said, without compassion, realizing emptiness will never lead us to true peace. And yet if I meditate solely on compassion, I will remain in samsara. I'm still not free. How can I be free? But the one who comes to embody both will dwell neither in samsara or nirvana. They will be non-abiding. They will be free of entanglements and being caught. That's why my teacher used to say that wisdom and compassion are inseparable. There is no gap. That wisdom without compassion can't be true wisdom. And compassion without wisdom can't be true compassion. And so that's why in our training, we're cultivating both all the time. To say that the path to true happiness lies within is true, but what does that mean? What do you do with that? The Buddha understood that. He says, this is what you can do. I call it a path. I call it an eightfold path. So when you meditate, this is what you can do in your meditation. This will actually help you. And in these days when meditation can mean kind of anything you want, meditation in Buddhism is presented, given to us as a path to take you from the beginning, right where you are, wherever that is, and go with you, guide you, and become more and more expansive as you become more and more expansive all the way. In the poem, Wu Men, this is sort of wonderful Zen koan teaching, if you understand it, your self-nature, your own complete, sufficient, from the beginning, nature. All things are one, if you understand that. But if you don't, then everything is different and separate. But then he goes on to say, if you do not understand it, all things are one. And if you do, they're different and separate. Understanding is used in different ways. Sometimes it means I have all of the ideas, I can tell you all about them, I can write a book about it. In fact, I think I will. There's an understanding which ultimately you can't write about. No one, even the Buddha, has never been able to give you that understanding. That's why even though we oftentimes might have moments where we just wish somebody could give it to us, right? Come on. How much? Right? I don't have much, but I'll cough up what I can, right? Can't be done. The teachings are given to us as an entry into that path and guidance along the way, but then we have to take it. Right? It's like somebody who, I remember being on the subway in the city one time, and I saw a young fellow who had a complete head-to-toe suit of armor to go fishing. They had everything, and it was so new. You could tell he had never worn this outside the house before. But he was going to fish. Some people might buy that and never actually leave the house. Never get wet. A student once asked Master Yunmen, what is a student's practice? And Yunmen said, it cannot be understood. And the student said, why can't it be understood? And Yunmen said, it just cannot be understood. It's not of that nature. There are many things that are like that. We can't understand them, and that's wonderful. But this cannot be understood. That's what those of you who've been here for the weekend have been immersing yourself in, an entry into that which cannot be understood. And yet when we do not understand it, the more we do not understand it, the more our lives, in a sense, are at risk. And I don't mean just Buddhist understanding, but I mean understanding, having some understanding of ourselves. I mean, if a Buddha person doesn't have a formal meditation, do they have anything in their life where there are moments where they stop, where all of the music is turned off, where they're quiet, where they reflect, where they have some entry into their inner world, where they're aware? So, I'll end with a short poem. The coming of dawn in a hall of Buddhas. First light, a bell sound. What is this? Vast robe liberating, formless field benefiting. The whole earth is clothed in wisdom. No one is forsaken. May that be so.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.